Well, if everyone's ready, we can begin. I'm Tom Matera. I'm the executive director of the Middle East Policy Council, and I'd like to welcome you to our 70th Capitol Hill Conference. Some of you know the council, but some of you do not, so I'll just take 1 minute to tell you what we do. Last year, we celebrated our 30th anniversary as a nonprofit educational organization. And this summer, we published the 30th anniversary issue of our journal, which is our flagship program, and the most frequently cited journal in its field of contemporary analysis of Middle Eastern policy questions, Middle East policy. We have a website, www.mepc.org, where you can find archived articles from previous issues of the journal. And our second program is this Capitol Hill Conference program, which, as I said, is our 70th. It's being live streamed. Anyone watching on live stream can ask questions from the website. And within a few days, you'll be able to see the entire video of this conference on the website. And then a few days later, the entire transcript will be available there. And then it will be published in the next issue of the journal, which will come out, I suppose, in December. And our third program is an outreach program where we provide information to teachers. It has been primarily teachers in the past. We're reaching out now to other people, such as religious leaders, World Affairs Councils, Rotary Clubs. And that's an effort to build citizen awareness of the issues that we have to deal with as a government. And of course, we have experts who provide commentary to the media. That's the Middle East Policy Council. If you would like to see articles, videos, etc., www.mepc.org. Now, before we go to this distinguished panel, I'd like to make a few introductory remarks just to set the stage. And then the panel will speak, and then we will have questions. This is about policy choices facing the next administration, whoever's going to be leading it. He is going to have some decisions to make. On Israeli-Palestinian questions, will the next administration resume the peace process in order to seek resolution of this conflict through establishment of a two-state solution? Will he be willing to expend political capital on this? Is it a national security interest of the United States to solve this and to get a two-state solution to this? Various members of this current administration have said so, and if that's true, it would be good to succeed. There are others who are not so sure that it's achievable or that political capital is worth spending on it. That's an important question, important decision for the next administration. If the next president wants to do this, he's going to have to build a domestic constituency to overcome opposition. On the question of the Iran-Syria-Hezbollah axis, the administration will have decisions to make about sanctions, about diplomacy, about war. If the Iranian regime comes to the table with serious intent for any reason, either because the sanctions are biting so hard or because they're worried about threats of military strikes or for any other reason, my question, as an individual, is will the American government take yes for an answer? Or will the American government have conditions that cannot be met by the other side? And would the administration even consider what was previously called a grand bargain, which would attempt to resolve all the outstanding issues between the United States and Iran, including what should Iran's role be in the region and what kind of attitude should they take toward the Arab-Israeli conflict and any potential peace agreement? Or would the next administration actually engage in military strikes against Iran? I would just note that there are three studies out very recently. You might want to think about one by the Iran Project, which is has a title of Weighing the Costs and Benefits of Military Strikes. People such as Anthony Zinni and Tom Pickering were associated with that report. And as the title suggests, it weighs the costs and benefits, and it's fairly comprehensive. One issue it doesn't touch on is covered by another report by Khosrow Samnani, published by the University of Utah's Hinckley Center, which goes into some depth about the casualties that would result from military strikes, the death and the injuries. And then finally, there's a report by the Bipartisan Policy Council or group, which goes into the costs of allowing Iran to get a nuclear weapon and the economic, particularly that, the economic costs that they think would follow from allowing Iran to get a nuclear weapon. So it's a big issue for everyone to be considering, especially the next president. When it comes to Syria, such a difficult case in the Arab awakenings, and one question that is current is, if we were to give them heavier weapons, would we promote the downfall of the Assad regime and promote the rise of a rebel opposition that would be friendly to the United States, or would they fall into the wrong hands and result in militias with weapons that could do to any Western power, to the United States, what was just done to our ambassador in Libya? So, are there really prospects for a democratic, pluralistic regime coming to power after Assad? And do we really have a role in a post-Assad transition? Or would we be putting our people in harm's way by trying to do that? When it comes to other cases in the Arab Spring, Jocelyn might want to correct me, but it looks as if we have a president from the Muslim Brotherhood who's establishing a very strong executive authority. And there are questions about whether we should be giving them foreign aid. And that's a question they'll have to wrestle with. In Bahrain, for example, we're dealing with a non-NATO ally with a record of progressive reform, still attempting to make some reform, but facing very determined opposition that has very significant support, especially from international human rights organizations. So how much reform do we ask the regime to engage in? Or how much might we be playing into the hands of anti-democratic forces in Bahrain? And finally, when we come to the Gulf, and I can testify to this from many trips to the Gulf, we need to decide what kinds of relationships we're going to have with the members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, who have security issues that they need to contend with, know very well that American defense industries can provide them with outstanding equipment, but at the same time, they have some questions about the extent of our security commitments to them, particularly given the way the administration rather quickly called for the Mubarak government to step down. They want business ties with the United States, but they see business opportunities elsewhere. They're very distressed by our Arab-Israeli policies, very distressed by our Arab-Israeli policies. I hear it all the time. Now we know that they're frustrated by our policies toward Iran and Syria, thinking we ought to be doing more in Syria, and worried about everything we might do with Iran, even diplomacy, which they fear might provide Iran with some advantages. And they're also concerned about our domestic Islamophobia and wonder what kinds of relations they can have with us when that kind of thing is occurring here. So those are my introductory ideas. I now want to say something about the panel and turn it over to them. And on the back of your invitation, you have very extensive bios of these distinguished speakers, so I won't repeat everything that is here. But our first speaker, who I'd like to be Scott McConnell, is a founding editor of the American Conservative, which was founded to provide an alternative voice to the neoconservative movement. And he identifies himself as an ex-neoconservative and has written for some magazines like Commentary. He's the former columnist and editorial writer for the New York Post, has a doctorate from Columbia University, and has written for our journal. And his articles in our journal have been some of the most popular that we've ever published. Then I'd like to go to Jocelyn Cesari, who is senior visiting professor at Johns Hopkins SAIS, School of Advanced International Studies, where she co-directs the Global Politics and Religion Initiative. She's also the director of the international research program called Islam in the West at Harvard University. So she splits her time between SAIS and Harvard. She's a political scientist from the French National Center for Scientific Research. She has written several books about Islam, globalization, democratization, and secularism. And our third speaker will be Nathaniel Kern, also a friend of the Middle East Policy Council. He's the president of Foreign Reports, provides incisive reports about Middle Eastern political and economic issues, particularly oil, particularly in the Gulf. You can find some of his reports on our website. Almost weekly?
Monthly, I think.
Monthly. I believe was the first foreign student to attend a university in Saudi Arabia, the University of Riyadh, in the middle of his Princeton undergraduate career, spent a year there. And then the fourth speaker is Paul Piller, who spent 28 years in the U.S. intelligence community and had many high-ranking positions in it, including executive director for the director of the CIA. And his final position was national intelligence officer for the Near East and South Asia, where he provided analytical support. He was a visiting fellow at Brookings in the year 2000 and is a reserve officer in the U.S. Army and has also been publishing extremely important literature in the last few years since retiring from the government. So we have a good panel. I'll step out of the way now. And again, thank you for coming. When we do finish this, there will be a question and answer session. Thank you.
John, watch all the wires.
I will.
Good morning. What are the prospects for a new president achieving a fair peace settlement between Israelis and Palestinians? I believe, unfortunately, that they are not very good. But by a fair settlement, I mean a two-state solution, a Palestinian state on comprising Gaza and the West Bank with some minor negotiated land swaps, with control of its border, its borders, its water resources, its airspace, something similar to the Clinton parameters of 2000. I believe that this outcome, more than any alternative, would satisfy the core needs for security and self-determination of both Israelis and Palestinians. As you know, every American president since Lyndon Johnson has tried to stop Israel from building settlements on the West Bank because they understood that those settlements threatened to foreclose the possibility of a two-state solution. Some presidents pushed hard, some not very hard. At Camp David, Jimmy Carter believed he had received from Menachem Begin assurances that settlement building would stop and that a process leading to Palestinian self-determination and autonomy on the West Bank would commence. But settlement building did not stop, and both Carter and the Egyptians, for different reasons, did not make too much of a fuss. Ronald Reagan called for a settlement freeze without making a big issue of it. George H.W. Bush did make a big issue of it and paid a steep political price, which may have cost him re-election. Bill Clinton wanted very much a viable Palestinian state, and he found that settlement building continued whether Israel was headed by Likud or by Labor, and it indeed accelerated throughout the 1990s. Barack Obama made a settlement freeze the jumping off point for his peace efforts and was smacked down decisively by Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israel lobby. The reason for these failures is obvious. Israel, no matter what coalition was in charge, wanted to build settlements on the West Bank more than the United States was committed to stopping them. The Israel lobby, which I would describe as a loose coalition of groups and individuals who are committed to ensuring American backing for Israel, no matter what Israel does, was able to generate enough political pressure to thwart serious American diplomacy to stop settlement building. Nevertheless, something important is beginning to happen. The Israel lobby is beginning to exhibit cracks and weaknesses. I believe we are witnessing the beginnings of an historic transformation in which its power will be considerably diminished. First, the Democratic Party. On the second night of the convention, roughly half the delegates in the hall, perhaps a quarter of the 6,000, voted no to what party leaders had assumed was a routine platform resolution amendment stating that Jerusalem was Israel's undivided capital. Such planks had appeared in both party platforms before, and in practice, presidents had ignored them, so not much of substance was at stake. But in the spirit, in the emotion, which is at the root of political change, a great deal happened. I'm sure many of you have seen the video. Three votes, three choruses of no, as unplanned as they were unexpected. Big party poobahs descended on the television booths to play down the episode. Alan Dershowitz described the naysayers as rogue elements, Arab Americans and anti-Zionist Jews, 1,500 of them apparently. What took place, I would call nothing less than a collective Rosa Parks moment. Let me quote one reaction from Alana Goodman of Commentary Magazine, which is now unabashedly a Republican publication. "This video," she wrote, "this video of the voice vote should chill every pro-Israel Democrat, scratch that, every pro-Israel American to the bone. Israel relies on bipartisan political support from the United States, its strongest ally. The floor vote at the Democratic Convention portends a day when that bipartisan support will cease to exist." As Tom said, I'm a former neoconservative in another life, used to write frequently for Commentary. I think Alana Goodman is completely correct that the contested vote does indeed portend such a day. How far in the future, I don't know. It was a decade between Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of the bus and the emergency of a sufficiently powerful anti-segregation consensus to pass civil rights legislation. For a major political party to become devoted to fairness between Israel and Palestine will take at least that long. But the reason that Alan Dershowitz and Commentary find the erosion of bipartisan support alarming is that partisanship would let loose a torrent of competitive debate about the morality and the utility of America's special relationship with Israel. Israel's treatment of the Palestinians under the occupation would be subject not only to academic and journalistic scrutiny, as it is now, but to political polemics. Something like the openly expressed behavior, something like the openly expressed skepticism about Israel's behavior now heard on elite university campuses would become widely disseminated. The special relationship's survival depends on its own rules of discourse. Israel's value to the United States is held to be so self-evident, its interests and values so obviously congruent to America's, that any criticism must be deemed marginal, weird, motivated by bigotry. Those who question the consensus are not debated and often smeared. But once the seal is broken, I believe, and I think Alana Goodman believes, the notion that it is some sort of metaphysical requirement to treat Israel as a privileged and adored touchstone of American Mideast policy could unravel with stunning speed. Other signs are pointing in the same direction. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions resolutions were voted upon in the National Methodist and Presbyterian conventions this summer. Neither passed, but the Presbyterian resolution fell short by 2 votes out of more than 600. More recently, leaders of several mainline churches made a formal request to Congress to investigate Israeli human rights violations to determine if Israel is violating the terms of use of the American weapons it receives. For a long time, Protestant churches have been inhibited on these questions. Their leaders instinctively gravitate towards warm ecumenical relations with mainstream Jewish organizations, with whom the mainline churches have built historic alliances on civil rights, on Vietnam, and on church-state relations. And yet these churches also have ties to the Arab world as educators and missionaries and social workers in refugee camps, and they have Arab co-religionists. They see themselves as promoters of social justice. Historically, this tension has always been resolved in favor of silence so as not to upset relations with America's Jewish leaders. That period, which has lasted since the founding of Israel, seems to be now over. Thirdly, the very obvious pushback against Israel's effort to persuade the United States to attack Iran or to support an Israeli strike or to accept Israeli advice over what timetables or red lines Washington should adopt. This has involved some firm public language, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs saying, "We don't want to be complicit in an Israeli attack," Secretary of State Clinton explicitly rejecting Israel's red lines, Obama not rearranging his schedule to meet with Netanyahu in New York. Of course, this wasn't over Palestine. It was over an issue with more immediate and obvious economic and security implications for the United States. But it was also the most unmistakable public defiance of Israel's wishes by an American president in a very long time. And though I'm assuming that the election is now a toss-up, the events I referred to were followed by Obama's largest lead in the polls this year. And if Obama loses, I think we can say with assurance that a public disagreement with Prime Minister Netanyahu had nothing to do with it. I could point to other areas, but you get the idea. Discussion of Israel-Palestine is opening up in historic ways. The Congress is a lagging indicator, still rolling out AIPAC-sponsored resolutions by the margins everyone is familiar with. But one day, the glasnost will penetrate up here as well. What relevance does this have for the next president? Unfortunately, I fear not very much. I won't say much about Mitt Romney. I would love to be proven wrong, but on the basis of his public statements, his private comments, which have become public, and his choice of foreign policy advisors, I believe there's no chance he will become engaged in restarting a genuine peace process. Obama is a different matter. He clearly wants a Palestinian state. He was decisively rebuked in the first year and a half of his administration. He couldn't persuade Israel to carry out a settlement freeze, much less withdraw from territory. Could next year be different? I've fallen into the camp of those who now think the time for a two-state solution has probably passed. I believe Israeli settlements on the West Bank have precluded the possibility. There are too many settlers, armed and intensely committed to remain there. It is not clear that any Israeli government could remove them without risking a civil war. And though there are mild Israeli polling majorities in favor of a two-state solution, there's no significant Israeli constituency for giving up any sovereignty over East Jerusalem, and a Palestinian state without Jerusalem as a capital is a non-starter. There is now one state between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, a state connected by a highly developed infrastructure of roads and water pipelines. I'm not sure when the point of return was passed. 7 years ago on my first visit to Israel, it still seemed quite plausible to speak of a Palestinian state. Now it does not. So I believe any kind of normal diplomatic process, appointment of a special envoy, searching for common ground, building on previous agreements, such as those arrived at under Prime Minister Olmert and Prime Minister Barak don't have much chance of success. There's no political majority in Israel in favor of withdrawing from the territory and settlements Israel would have to do to allow a genuinely economically viable Palestinian state. Prime Minister Netanyahu, I know, has given lip service to the idea, but people close to him have said he would never offer the Palestinians something he could accept. An archipelago of Bantustans on the West Bank, areas A and B, cut off from the world, without control of their airspace, their water, will not produce a viable state. So what can the next president do to change this? The only intervention which might shake Israel out of its current spiral would be if a president made clear where the United States sees this heading. Absent a two-state solution, Israel is en route to becoming an apartheid state. Israelis will not willingly accept granting Palestinians voting or civil rights. So we're headed towards a state roughly half Palestinian, half Jewish, one group denied political and civil rights, the other group possessing them. Could President Obama cite words that previous Israeli prime ministers have said, have warned quite unambiguously that Israel would be facing an apartheid situation in the absence of a two-state solution? Could Obama tell the Israelis that, regardless of who is president, it will be very difficult for America to maintain a special relationship with an apartheid state in the middle of the Middle East, that such an alliance would contravene America's values and interests, and that once the relevant question in the one state that exists between the river and the sea is whether Palestinians should have equal voting rights as Jews, it will be natural, given America's democratic ideology and its history, that it will support Palestinian voting rights. Failure to do so would not make sense to most Americans, and in a practical sense would render it impossible for the United States to speak credibly in favor of democracy or human rights in the Middle East or anywhere else in the world. In other words, the centerpiece of the president's intervention would be shifted from the Palestinians and their historic suffering and their need for self-determination. I'm pretty sure most Israelis don't care very much about that. It would be about American values and American interests and where Israel fits into them. I'm not sure that such a speech, perhaps accompanied by diplomatic measures such as not using America's UN veto on Israel's behalf, or perhaps even supporting pro-Palestinian measures, would change the political calculus in Israel. Perhaps it would not have impact at all. It would have no impact at all. Do I think President Obama might say something like this, speaking before the Knesset, perhaps? Of course I don't. If the Israel lobby is getting weaker, it is still very powerful. America is not yet ready for a presidential approach like this. A reelected President Obama would have more pressing priorities besides a viable state in Palestine, and priorities more easy to achieve. But I don't think anything less dramatic and less forceful has any chance of success.
Thank you. I hope you're wrong. the next speaker will be Jocelyn.
Don't tangle up.
Watch these. There you go.
Good morning. I would like first to thank the Middle East Policy Council for this gathering and for this debate. I would like to focus my remarks on the changes needed in the U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis the country is going through what was called the Arab Spring, now the Arab Awakening. And I would like to first say that we went through lots of up and downs since the revolution of last year. We, from an American approach, we saw the Tahrir protests as the sign of democracy that we thought were not there. Then after the elections, we were disappointed by the victory of Islamists. And in the last 6 months, so we went from enthusiasm to disappointment, and now we are in the pessimist phase, in the sense that recent events like the protest against the anti-Mohammed movie have led some of the analysts and policymakers to link the failure of the Arab Spring with this unfortunate episode. So my talk will really focus first on the fact that democracy is a value that is now shared by the majority, especially the young people of all Muslim majority societies. Does it mean that it's a democracy we experience in the West, and especially in the US? Probably not. And we have to be aware of that. And based on this assessment, I would like to draw a few elements for changes in foreign policy. In some way, the West, and that's what the Arab Spring showed, the West is victim of its success, in the sense that the Jasmine Revolution and the Tahrir protests show that now the democratic values are not anymore, I would say, Western. And this has not been thought through sufficiently. I mean, we are not paying attention enough to the fact that democracy is persistently praised by members, citizens of Muslim majority countries. There are tons of pollings showing that, multiple pollings, that repeatedly show that actually, in some instances, when they are polled, these people say that they are more in favor to democracy than the average of respondents you can find in a Western country. And this hope in democracy is still there, despite the, I would say, the questioning or the skepticism around the new regime that came from elections. So people also disconnect the limits of the new regime with this hope for democracy. And I think it's important to maintain this positive outlook on what's going on. And we tend, unfortunately, to go very quickly from one assessment to another without taking into account indicators that are there. The fact that Muslim societies were in favor of democracy, we knew that, at least as scholars, for a long, long time. This didn't come with the Arab Spring. It was already there in facts and investigation that are available to everybody. So this is the first thing. The second point here is, but what kind of democracy are we talking about? And in this regard, I would like to make a difference between what is showed as a consensus, which is the principle of political freedom, freedom of political expression and opposition. In other words, the fact that rulers have to be elected, that they can change from one election to another, is now pretty much grounded in most, the majority of these countries. Does it mean that we are witnessing a sort of secularization in the American sense of this country? Probably not. Probably not. So we have also to disconnect a few elements that we have considered as the whole package of democratization, which is democratization goes with secularization and goes with decline of religion in public space. And this, we have to be very aware that this is not happening. And in this sense, the protest against the anti-Mohammed movie show us that Islam remains a very strong marker of the public space, which from the West is always difficult to understand because we think that religion is private, that religion concerns only our beliefs. we're going to have to understand, and it's not true only for Muslims, it's true, I could talk to you about India in the same way. We're going to have to understand that for Muslims, Islam is not only a question of belief, it's also a question of belonging and being a national citizen. What do I mean by that? It is not because, as I hear everywhere, that Islam doesn't separate politics and religion, which is actually, looking at the Islamic tradition, wrong. But it is that since the building of the nation states, even by very secular elite that we used to work with, like Mubarak or Ataturk or Bourguiba, Islam has been embedded in the building of nation state. What do I mean by that? It's not only mentioning Islam in the constitution. It is also creating connection between being a national and being a citizen. And again, this didn't come from Islamists. What we are witnessing is how the new regime led by Islamists have to work within a framework that already was there. So again, the blasphemy law were not an invention of the recent regime. They were already there. Today, it's a major debate in Tunisia about how to remove laws that sanction people who would say something insulting against the prophet or the religion. This was already there under the secular Bourguiba and Ben Ali regime. So again, we have to be very careful on how we assess this kind of event in a more, I would say, complex picture, where instead of looking at Islamists as a separate entity challenging secular states, we have to take into account what are the state institutions, what are their situation today that also influence the interaction with the Islamists. And I think we have not done that, and it requires a very different outlook on what's going on, meaning accepting that indeed democratic values are shared now beyond the West, but does it mean that everywhere we're going to witness a duplication of the American model of democracy? Probably not. Does it mean that then we reject the whole experience? It would not be a wise move. And this brings me to my second point on what does it mean for the US foreign policy? We are at a time now where talking about promotion of democracy is very, I would say, criticized or rejected. And I understand why, because if you look at the popularity of U.S. Of the U.S. In this part of the world, you see a consistent and repeated decline of positive opinion vis-à-vis the U.S. And there have been lots of assessment of previous attempts to promote democracy, so I'm not going to go there. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that we have to abandon or renounce to a promotion of democracy. So it means not promoting values, not considering that the West has to teach democracy to the other parts of the world, but to create some kind of partnership. And this is possible because this has been done by US administration, particularly in the Eastern European context. You can see how a successful democratization policy worked in the Eastern European context by two elements that maybe we can learn from and invest in Muslim majority country. It was establishing a good communication with the target audience in a functioning marketplace of ideas. And I think this is missing in the way we are dealing with Muslim majority countries. Of course, since the Arab Spring, we are aware that communication matters. Actually, we are, I would say, too much aware of it because now the social media have become the panacea to solve everything. Why the social media, and I know there have been a lot of investment in the current administration to communicate through this channel with different segments of civil societies in the Muslim world. But what do we communicate? What are we paying attention to? And I would say here that words are loaded. When we say democracy again, it may not mean the same thing for someone living in Rabat or Tunis. When we hear the term Sharia, it doesn't mean what we are afraid of here, which is, you know, the imposition of a medieval barbaric code of law. And again, we don't make enough effort to clarify this kind of, you know, heavy loaded terms in any communication with this part of the world. I remember when the new transitory regime in Libya took over, one of the first declarations was, we're going to impose Sharia in the country. And this was, you know, considered as very, very worrying from the Western eye. While what does Sharia mean there? I mean, maybe it means, and I can explain this a little more in detail, maybe in Q&As, it may be simply principles, like, you know, the Ten Commandments. If in the U.S. some politician will refer to the Ten Commandments, it would not be seen as, you know, a backward move toward the religious state. So maybe Sharia is used this way. And in this particular context, Tunisia is a very good example of this move from reference to principle from imposition in concrete law of what would be Sharia. I think this is also important to watch and just not take at face value what people are saying, because there is a lot of relationship of power in the use of words. I know this may not be sound too realistic in terms of international relations, but symbolic matters. And we have not paid attention enough to the symbolic aspect of the communication with this part of the world. And so incidents are adding up, you know, from the Quran desecration to, I would not consider the anti-Mohammed movie as, you know, something that was part of U.S. foreign policy, but we have to deal with it, okay? And it's, apology is good, but this is, I would say, a very reactive approach. Well, we need to be much more proactive in the way we communicate. So what does this mean? If we want to target audiences or actors that can promote a vision of democratization that include not only free and fair elections, but other elements like pluralistic approach of society, we have to change also the way we interact as a multiple set of institutions and governmental agencies with this country. We have given too much priority to the leaders. And it's true that in the current administration also, there is effort to diversify, and there have been before also using, you know, NGOs. But then it turns into a very compartmentalized approach, with one hand of the administration doing one thing with NGOs and another hand doing something else with the state. And sometimes these two elements do not add up or do not come into synergy. And it's, I think it's in some way very heartbreaking from an American point of view, because we put a lot of money through all this action in this particular part of the world. What comes back is from the society is we are doing nothing. So again, how do we make this work in a way that is more transparent, that is more coordinated? And this goes with the vows and wishes of the population. You know, they toppled Mubarak and Ben Ali because they wanted transparency, because they wanted a more equal distribution of resources. So it means also maybe thinking of another way that instead of doing one thing here and another thing here, create platforms and make, you know, the different way that American is involved with the country meet each other. To give a concrete example, it did happen in American policy. When in Sudan, you can object, and I would take the objection. In Sudan, at the time of reconstruction, this is a very successful example of the convergence and synergy of multiple administrative and political units of the U.S. administration coming together to help rebuild the country and also bringing different elements, not only state institutions, but also civil society's movement. And in this sense, there is a lot of to think of. So the point would not be to add or increase the aid. It would be more about thinking of creating spaces or interfaces that would make this help much more efficient, and that would also change the outlook of the U.S. In this part of the world. I think that focusing only on state work is counterproductive, because again, the state is seen as biased, and our previous speaker explained why the bias is there. But there is a huge resource that Americans are not using enough, which is the American society itself. I was very surprised. I did a lot of focus groups of American Muslims when they live in the U.S. and coming from Pakistan, Egypt, or Iraq, the first thing that they discover is the energy, vibrancy of Americans. And they tend to dissociate between, you know, the U.S. foreign policy and American society. And most of them, all of them, are very positive on that. And every time they tell in these groups, we didn't know, because we see only, you know, the foreign policy aspect. So there is something here in terms of communication also that could be helpful. So what does it mean? It means also multilateralism. I know this is not very popular, but it may work too, because also looking at what the EU is doing in this part of the world, lots of initiatives could be put together. And especially in Libya now, or in Tunisia. And again, the most extremist or resistant actors play on the division, not only of their own politicians, but also of the division and compartmentalized work of the West in these different parts of the world. So again, the idea of platforms here is something to think of, and it has been working in some cases. To finish up, I would like to say that the work is huge, because it means thinking of how we interact or engage from the very concrete aspects of who does what in these different parts of the world. One, it also means being able to identify locally and not only through the internet. The internet is nice, but it gives a very deceptive approach of what people are doing. You know, and I know it's, again, the social media doesn't make revolution. Education makes revolution. Urban middle class makes revolution, not the social media. And for that, we need to be more aware of indicators emerging and who is doing what now in these different civil societies. And for that, I think that the need is a better understanding to be able to bring in skills. People in this part of the world, and I will finish really on that, are admiring the U.S. for its capacity of education, for its capacity of entrepreneurship. Of course, we can bring entrepreneurs from the Middle East to visit the U.S. or vice versa. It doesn't create the positive cross-pollination with state institutions. How do we make this work? And this would be a very important way to build more secure societies, because as we know, democracies do not fight each other. So what I'm lining up here is some elements for a more long-term approach, which may be very frustrating, especially in time of elections. But on the long run, there are sufficient assets that could be used, and we could start using right now to change the interaction with this part of the world. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nat Kern?
Thank you very much. My job in this panel is probably a little easier than the jobs others have, because it's basically to discuss the policy choices that the next administrator, the next person in the White House, could be Obama or the governor, will face in terms of dealing with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. The way I like to think of it is, I think in whatever the outcome of the election, there's going to be a new Secretary of State, I believe. And how would a professional foreign policy official brief that new secretary before he or she had a first substantive meeting with Saudi leaders? What would be the issues that briefer would want to put on the table and say, hey, here are the things you got to discuss, here are the questions that should be on the agenda? And I think any good briefer would go back and say, well, what have been the previous interactions between American presidents and the Saudi leadership? And you would start really with the meeting between then Crown Prince Abdullah and George W. Bush in Texas in 2005, when the Crown Prince suggested and the President agreed that they would form a strategic dialogue committee. And one of the reasons for wanting to have a strategic dialogue committee headed by the Foreign Minister and the Secretary of State was, prior to that, there were an awful lot of issues coming from all different parts of the government complaining about this kind of Saudi behavior or this, and there was no overall way to put things in context. What was the context of religious freedom, human rights, democratic values versus cooperation on peace process, oil markets, and other things? And one of the things that the strategic dialogue did was put everything on a table for a once every 6 month review by the top leadership. Back in 2005, the main issues that were on the agenda were counterterrorism, how do you go against terrorists themselves, terror finance, how do you clamp down on loose money going to, wittingly or unwittingly, to terror groups, the issue of visas for Saudis, Saudi Arabia's desire to finally join the World Trade Organization, peace process, and oil prices and Saudi plans for expanding capacity. That was in 2005. I think you can say, if you look back, we pretty much ticked the box on counterterrorism. You've got a very well-admired counterterror operations in Saudi Arabia, where they've both on the educating the public and tracking down people, identifying, tracking them down, prosecuting them, and then often trying to rehabilitate them. I don't know of any American official who thinks they're severely lacking in that. There's been a great deal of praise on how far they've gone. It took a little longer for the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to work together on terror finance. But a year ago, the Treasury held a sort of a September review of where things stood on cooperation with Saudi Arabia on those two issues. And you had the fellows Stuart Levy and Fran Townsend from the previous administration and the current ones. And during that symposium, what I was struck with was the unanimity with which all those officials felt there'd been very substantial progress, and that basically these boxes of counterterrorism, terror finance had been ticked off, and they need continued attention. But those are no longer issues you would put on the next secretary's agenda. They're done. You can tick the box off. The visa issue, which was very contentious in 2005, is pretty much done. Between 2000 and 2005, you had an average of about 3,000 Saudi students studying here in the United States. And, of course, after 9/11, there was an awful lot of scrutiny of the visas. People were held up. Students would often miss a year because their visas would expire, and then they'd have to go back and wait in line. Now you have 60,000 Saudi students here. The visa problem has been solved. They get five-year visas, and Americans get five-year multiple entry visas to Saudi Arabia. And I think it's worked very well. I think the fact that the King Abdullah has provided scholarships for those 60,000 Saudi students is an example of where he wants to bring the country. He wants 60,000 people to come back with a good view of American values. And I would point out parenthetically that among those 60,000, there's a disproportionately high representation of Saudi Shia. Saudi ID cards don't identify whether you're Sunni or Shia, but as people look and try to figure who's who, yeah, it's considerably, perhaps double the percentage of Shia in Saudi Arabia are getting scholarships here. I think that's good. Again, in 2005, the big question was oil prices and what the Saudi plans for expanding capacity were. Oil Minister Naimi was there, Cheney was there, and basically they described this program that they were then launching to expand production capacity by 2.5 million barrels a day. And that's done. We still have considerably higher oil prices now than we did in 2005. They've been accelerating. But that's, I think, largely a result of growing world demand outside of the OECD. And unless there's some change in that, we're going to have continued fairly robust pricing. Now, if you're briefing the new secretary, you could go over what are the boxes that have been ticked and successfully done, but what are the new issues that would face? And obviously, one of them, an issue that is worth discussing because he can take actionable action together between our country and Saudi Arabia, is the fallout from the Arab Spring, particularly in Egypt and Yemen. I think we know that Saudi Arabia had mixed feelings about how quickly Mubarak was dumped, but they also, the Saudis, played a very crucial role in easing Ali Abdullah Saleh out of Yemen. It wasn't easy. It was slow. It was bloody. But it, compared to some of the other changes, it wasn't that bad. In April of 2011, just as the Arab Spring was in its full bloom, if you will, the G7 finance ministers met in Deauville, France, and formed something called the Deauville Partnership. Their vision was very simple, that Europe had been through this kind of thing before. After Eastern Europe broke away from the yoke of the Warsaw Pact, you had a whole bunch of newly independent countries struggling with democracy, but also with economy. How do you go from a controlled communist economy to a free economy and make it work? And what Europe had done, basically, was establish the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which was modeled on what the World Bank did to help Western Europe and Japan after World War II. And the EBRD basically provided capital funds plus the things we've all learned about how to do things right rather than wrong in building a new economy. What laws do you need? What structural reforms do you need? What's the best place to put money, not just throwing it down black holes? At the Deauville Partnership, it's again the G7 finance ministers, which is the G8 minus Russia, and then they included in their meeting the Saudi finance minister, the Qatari finance minister, and the Turkish finance minister. So the Deauville Partnership on the donor giving advice side was the G7 plus those three countries. And then on the potential recipient side was Egypt, later Libya in terms not of money, but can we help you in planning and economic revival. Just last month, Yemen's on the list, Tunisia, of course, and tangentially, Morocco and Jordan. They hadn't gone through a transition period, but they also needed economic assistance. Both Saudi Arabia and Qatar have been quite proactive in extending aid to Egypt, both before and after Mohamed Morsi was elected. And I think it's important to understand what sort of aid. Some of the things Egypt needed right away was an ability to sell government bonds and treasury bills, because it's currently paying about 14% interest, which is pretty high on for a government. And in the immediate depths of this summer, when things look terrible, both the Saudis and Qataris came in and said, okay, we'll buy your 1 month's issue of T-bills. Obviously, you get pretty good security of repayment unless the government defaults and everything. But that has helped relieve some of the interest pressure and try to move Egypt out of the debt trap it's in. It's in a worse debt trap than Greece or Italy or Spain. The second thing that both the Saudis and Qatar has done, they have, like the World Bank, there's the Islamic Development Bank, various quite good development banks that help identify investment projects, make sure they're built without corruption and that they become effective. I think it's $4.5 billion that Qatar and Saudi Arabia have extended to Egypt. And that has helped now the IMF. Christine Lagarde was out there in September, and they're working on a loan program, very easy terms, very low interest rate and forgiveness, that would be another $4.5 billion or so for Egypt. If those things are combined, then Egypt has a fighting chance to get an economy back on its feet. If you have an economy back on its feet, then it's a little easier to talk about equitable division of resources. If the resource base is going down the tube, you're in a pretty desperate situation. And again, they're starting to talk about doing this with Yemen, too, which is, of course, an area the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have cooperated on a lot, on counterterrorism, on the GCC initiative to get the transition in power. But now really the thing is, how do you get this desperately poor country running out of everything all at once? Give it a chance to get back on its feet. At least they're working together on that. The big issues that you want to brief the next secretary on are, of course, Iran, sanctions, and Syria. The imposition of the current set of sanctions by the U.S. and the EU would not have been possible without pre-agreement with Saudi Arabia last November, that if those sanctions led to Iran's losing up to or a little more than half of its oil exports, would Saudi Arabia be willing to step in and make up those exports so the price wouldn't go through the roof? They agreed. And I think with the caveat that we probably can't make up, Saudis can't make up all of Iran's exports, where there'd be some mechanism to totally shut them down, because that would take Saudi production right up to there and leave no spare capacity, which tends to be a driver for higher oil prices. So as the sanctions have come about, we had some bumpiness in the oil market, particularly in the spring in anticipation. But as they've been implemented, I think we've had at least a stabilization of oil prices at somewhat lower rates than were expected. And we're going to see whether these sanctions have an influence on Iranian decision-making. To me, the bottom line is, you know, is Iran really willing to seriously talk about giving up its nuclear weapons program? If they are, I don't see there's a big problem in resolving the whole issue. If they want to prevaricate and have a situation where it's sort of talking about their nuclear weapons program, then the sanctions are probably going to remain for some time, or at least until some other situation arises. I don't think the next administration is going to have a terribly difficult time with Saudi Arabia one way or the other. If diplomacy works, that's fine. They have full diplomatic relations and fully correct relations with Iran. If it produces an end to the Iranian nuclear weapons program. If not, there are different views in Saudi Arabia, and some feel very supportive of a military strike, and others are a little more fearful of it. On Syria, we're in a state of limbo where the Saudis and Qataris have been providing more arms to the Syrian opposition. And I think it's been widely reported that the U.S. has said, please hold off in providing the very effective shoulder-fired missiles that can hit airplanes and tanks. And we're still sort of in limbo with that. I think there's some of those more sophisticated weapons near the borders of Syria, but they're not getting to the opposition in Syria. That's been a point that I think President Romney has made, that he would be in favor of working with the Saudis and Qataris to ensure that the Syrian opposition gets the weapons it needs to hit Assad's planes and tanks. And as far as I know, this is still tied up in the Principles Committee in terms of what actions we should or should not take, and with arguments being, on the one hand, we don't want these arms to go to people we don't know, dangerous people, and the other being, if you leave Assad in place and he prevails, what kind of world is that? So those, I think, would be the big issues on the agenda. Middle East peace process. If there's something actionable that can be done, Saudis be very supportive. I think at the moment, they want to get on with the rest of their lives as long as they can see that this is a riddle that is not going to be solved anytime soon. The final issue would be always on agenda would be oil market stability, and that's been an issue for between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia since FDR first met Ibn Saud in 1945. The U.S. didn't import any oil. We were an oil exporter at the time. But for FDR and the 12 presidents that followed him, it's been a very simple formulation. If you understand the size and importance of Saudi oil reserves, whether the U.S. needs to import oil or not, you don't want those oil reserves to fall into the hands or under the indirect control of hostile elements, whether that's the Soviet Union, Saddam Hussein, or currently the Ayatollahs. The world would be very different if hostile powers held the oil resources of the Gulf. They would be able to control the world economy. And that's something that, again, the past 13 presidents have not wanted to contemplate. And so that's sort of be the perennial issue on the table, and it tends to guide the rest of the relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, Nat. Paul.
Good morning. As the cleanup hitter, I've been asked to address Iran and Syria, which I will do in that order with most of the attention devoted to the first of those two topics. And I would say on both of them, there will be, as we head into the new administration next year, pressures on the U.S. president, whoever he is, to do more, to get involved more on both of those issues. But on each one, there will either be no good choices for the administration to make, or if there are at least reasonable choices that could be taken, it will be politically difficult back here in the United States for the president, whoever he is, to select them. Let's talk first about Iran. There are many potentially useful departures that a U.S. administration could make with regard to Iran, which would involve trying to improve the absolutely awful relationship that we have with the Iranians and to actually get some benefit in areas where U.S. and Iranian interests, believe it or not, parallel or intersect, like Afghanistan, like stability in Iraq, and so on. But there will continue to be a fixation on one issue above all, and that's the Iranian nuclear program. And that's mainly because of the unceasing agitation on this topic by the current Israeli leadership. There will be, of course, an election in Israel, too, in the first part of the year, but all of the prognoses I've seen with regard to the likelihood, the likely outcome of that is that we will still have Prime Minister Netanyahu as Prime Minister, even if there might be some adjustments in the ruling coalition. And that, of course, means a continued political environment here in the United States, at least in the short term, even though we might hope for Scott's long-term prognosis to come true, in which the issue of the Iranian nuclear program will necessarily be a political fixation, continue to be one here in the United States. Now, an obvious constraint for either Mr. Obama or Mr. Romney as president beginning in January 2013 would be that either would be boxed in by their own comments repeatedly stated by both of them that an Iranian nuclear weapon would be unacceptable. And of course, there have been statements here on the Hill by Congress along the same sorts of lines. Now, that would not necessarily have to be a problem, given that there is no indication to date, as our intelligence agencies tell us, that Iran has decided so far to build a nuclear weapon. But certain aspects of their nuclear program, particularly enrichment of uranium, have come to be perceived in the debate as having a degree of unacceptability of their own. And of course, the Israeli Prime Minister talks about this constantly and about so-called red lines and so forth. Now, avoiding having this situation turn into a disaster for whoever's administration it is a problem mainly of political constraints here in this country, rather than any lack of negotiating space between Iran and the P5 plus one, the negotiating group that the United States is part of. You would have to have, an agreement, an allowing of some uranium enrichment, probably at the no more than 5% level. The outlines of an agreement are pretty clear. They would involve trading severe restrictions to be negotiated on median level or 20% enrichment in return for sanctions relief. And we should bear in mind that sanctions relief is the main reason that the Iranians have to negotiate at all at this point. Now, on the first aspect about the 20%, there is stuff that needs to be negotiated, not just ending the 20% enrichment that's going on now, but also what would be the disposition of the stockpile that Iran already has, although happily the Iranians have already helped resolve that problem by converting some of the fuel at that level to fuel plates for reactors where it's no longer usable to be further enriched to weapons grade. And then there would also have to be negotiation over the sequence of when does each side live up to parts of its part of the bargain? And the Iranians reportedly placed a proposal on the table, which was unacceptable to the West in that their preferred sequence, understandably, would be to have what they want in terms of sanctions relief come first before they give up what they'd have to give up with regard to the median level enrichment. The P5 plus one preference is, of course, the opposite. And that's a very common situation in international negotiations. Naturally, each side wants to get what it wants first before giving up anything else. And it's also very common that this is one of the most eminently compromisable things in negotiations. It's not an indivisible good. And the usual solution is some kind of sequencing arrangement, in which at each stage, each side both gives and gets. So the outlines of an agreement are, as I say, pretty clear, and I would go so far as to describe our current state of affairs, if we were serious about negotiating over it, as a matter of details. Exactly how do we handle that 20% stuff that's already been enriched, and exactly what will be the sequence for implementation. Now, the sanctions that we talk about so much and that keep getting ratcheted up and up and up and up are supposedly, ostensibly, a form of leverage to get the Iranians to make concessions on this nuclear issue. And Secretary Clinton, not too long ago, described the sanctions in exactly those terms. She said, if the Iranians will make concessions, then this is a problem we can deal with in terms of, you know, offering sanctions relief. The main problem so far is the P5 plus one has not put any sanctions relief on the table as an offer, except for the sole minor exception of airplane spare parts. And so the principal problem right now, in terms of where the negotiations stand, is that the Iranians have been given no reason, or certainly no assurance, to believe that the sanctions won't just continue on and on and on, no matter what they do with regard to their nuclear policy. And that obviously kills any incentive to make concessions on their part. Now, the problem for the new U.S. president, whichever one it is, come January, will be to find political space to be flexible with regard to the sanctions. Prime Minister Netanyahu will reject any loosening of sanctions. In fact, he's rejected the whole idea of negotiations, basically, out of hand. And this, of course, will continue to have obvious implications with regard to shaping the political climate here in the United States. We also have those who hope, both here and in Israel, that the squeeze of sanctions will somehow hasten regime change in Iran. In other words, it's some other purpose besides leverage for getting concessions on the nuclear issue. And that's notwithstanding the prospect that even if there were regime change, and I certainly would not advise holding your breath and waiting for it, that it would mean whoever comes into power in Tehran would fold on the nuclear issue. Not likely, given the broad support that a nuclear program, a peaceful nuclear program, has in Iran. Note also that a lot of the U.S.-imposed sanctions, as embedded in legislation, have had other issues besides the nuclear one stated as rationales, human rights, that sort of thing, relations with terrorist groups. And so it would be very difficult here on the Hill to get back down on that, even if the negotiations went well with the Iranians. All these constraints put together do not augur very well for taking advantage of that negotiating space that does exist and showing flexibility and using sanctions for what they ostensibly are to be used for, that is, as leverage, which requires you to be flexible. It requires you to put offers on the table that you will get relief if the other side makes concessions, something we haven't put on the table so far, rather than as some kind of unending punishment, which, as I said, gives the Iranians no incentive to concede. Perhaps the only offsetting basis for optimism I could cling to is that anyone who is even halfway briefed on this issue will know that there is a clear basis for an agreement along the lines that I just briefly outlined. And with some flexibility on sanctions, an agreement can be achieved. We shouldn't be surprised that this issue, as we move through 2013, staggers on in pretty much the form that we see it today. Don't be deceived by talk about zones of immunity and implied deadlines and so on. Despite the bursts of talk that suggest urgency, you know, this talk isn't all that new. I mean, it really hasn't changed form for the last several years. Certainly since Mr. Netanyahu has been prime minister in Israel. Bear in mind that those agitating most loudly on this issue have other reasons to agitate, including distracting attention from other problems, particularly the problem that Scott discussed. And if anything, that's a reason for them to continue agitating about this issue rather than to actually resolve it. Although both presidential candidates have boxed themselves in with statements about the unacceptability of an Iranian nuclear weapon, there are bases for anticipating some differences with regard to how our own election is going to come out. The main one is that for Mr. Obama, if he wins, he would be a second-term president, never running for office again, with some more basis because of that for perhaps taking some political risks in the interest of introducing the flexibility that would be necessary to reach an agreement. Whereas Mr. Romney would be running for re-election from day one, and on anything involving Israel and the concerns of Prime Minister Netanyahu, a President Romney would have to wonder what Sheldon Adelson would say the next time he happens to see him. Now, Iran may not force any U.S. president over the next 4 years, even, to come to terms with the nuclear weapon is unacceptable idea, because, as I say, they haven't made a decision even to make one, and they could just stick with their declared intent not to make one. So we may never see the true presidential bottom lines on this issue on our side. But one final observation on this. The fact that military force would be, certainly in my view, a counterproductive folly should be clear enough that a second-term Obama administration would do just about anything they could to avoid it. For Mr. Romney, the issue, of course, has been so far, how shall I put it, an epiphenomenon of the need to show no daylight between him and the Israeli leadership and what his own personal bottom line would turn out to be on the Iranian nuclear issue itself if he were in office is anyone's guess. But his election clearly would mean the return to policymaking positions of some of those who indeed do not believe that war with Iran would be a counterproductive folly. So that's a huge fudge factor. Now some briefer observations about Syria. And here the segue is that in many people's eyes, some of what's most important in terms of what's going on in Syria is the Iranian connection, the idea that the Assad regime has been the biggest ally or the only ally of Tehran in the Arab world. And so there's been this hope that's built up that if we can get regime change there, this would be a big blow to Iran. Actually, the chief considerations in Syria and the problems it will present for the new U.S. administration are not so much about the Iranian connection, but about other considerations, ones going on inside Syria. Two major factors, I think, shape this issue as we think about it in the year ahead. One is there will be continued pressure to do something, to do more. One only has to read the Washington Post editorial page where there's tub thumping on this about every other day. And this in turn is driven by two things. One, the humanitarian concern about the bloodshed, very understandable. And secondly, a desire to give Assad a push to get rid of this regime, partly because of the Iran alliance consideration and just because of general, anti-dictatorial sentiments and the hope that we'll have something like a democracy that could emerge in Syria. The other major factor is that there is, in fact, very little, if anything, the U.S. could do right now that would shorten rather than intensify the war, and that would not run the risk of becoming some sort of slippery slope toward a much deeper U.S. involvement than most Americans, the overwhelming majority of Americans, would want. The main problems that underlie the latter factor are not about to go away. The chief one is the prospect of the pro-Assad forces hanging on for a long time, however desperate their situation sometimes seems to get from day to day as we read about the opposition doing this or doing that. And I'd say the main factor behind that, and something that makes Syria different from Libya, for example, is the sectarian dimension, which we didn't have in Libya, and the fact that you've got the whole Alawite community that, to greater or lesser degrees, mostly greater, sees itself linked, for better or for worse, with this regime and fears, with good reason, what their fate and what their future would be if the largely Sunni opposition takes control. There are also big questions and problems on the opposition side in terms of the disunity, in terms of the radical influence, and not having anything close to something we could point to that gives us confidence that there would be someone or something that could establish stability and order if the regime were to crumble next week. Getting into some of the issues that Nat touched on, and there was a David Sanger article in the New York Times just a few days ago that appropriately got a lot of attention, and that has to do with the arms supplies from the Saudis and Qataris to some of the Syrian opposition, and the concern that was expressed, understandable concern, that these arms seem to be going into radical hands of militant jihadists. All this kind of replayed in my mind what was going on in Afghanistan more than 20 years ago, where we were trying to support, we and the Saudis were trying to support the fight against the Soviets, and we had to work with the opposition militias that were in place, the most effective fighters among whom were hardline jihadists. People like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who then later, you know, came to be considered an enemy of ours. And that's basically the kind of situation we've got in Syria. And it should not surprise us that not only can we not fine-tune who gets the weapons and have them go only to people who share our values, but also that the more extreme militants are the ones who tend to be the best fighters in an extreme, brutal civil war. That's the way it was in Afghanistan. That's the way it seems to be in Syria. Now, despite the efforts of candidates, of course, to show that they're somehow different, I look at what the current administration's saying and doing and what Governor Romney is saying, and I don't see much difference in the basic positions. The only basis one can have to infer a difference is, again, the prospect that you'll have a neoconservative entree into a Romney administration, which requires us to take an all-bets-are-off approach with regard to any new initiatives that involve military force. Some of what may shape or even force new decisions on whoever is the new president would involve how the Syrian civil war affects or is engaging other states in the region. Now, I say that even though I don't subscribe to the frequent thing you hear about civil wars spreading across boundaries as if they're molasses that kind of oozes across the map. That usually doesn't happen. However, we've got some important players, the most important one being Turkey. Because it's a NATO ally, because the Turks understandably have to defend their borders, and look what's happened to them lately, mortar and artillery shells that have killed their citizens across the border, they have to do something about that. And insofar as they want to make good on their opposition to support for the Assad regime, they also have to do things like force down airliners in their airspace that are shipping material to Syria. And so there might be things that happen to the Turks that force their hand, which, because they are an important ally of ours, forces the hand of the U.S. president in some way. There's also the obvious potential for things being stirred up in Lebanon because of the special relationship and the geographical facts between Syria and Lebanon, but that can go into so many directions, I'm not going to try to game it out here. Then you have what Nat was talking about, the concerns of the Gulf Arabs and especially the Saudis about the fate of their Sunni brethren in Syria. And I think this is something that the United States will have to deal with, and for this reason, I would say that the handling by the new administration of the Syrian problem will be at least as much a function of U.S. relations with the Gulf Arabs and especially the Saudis. In sum, except for the optimistic note that I struck earlier, that there is negotiating space to be explored and exploited on this Iranian nuclear issue that's got so much attention, I really don't see many apparent opportunities for productive departures and advances in either of these areas by whoever is president come January.